From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection later this hour was made in Rochester in 1952. A man named Freddie Thomas moved to Rochester. Thomas became known for his pioneering research in genetics and plastic surgery at the University of Rochester. But perhaps just as importantly, his Rochester home became a kind of quiet community center, welcoming people to talk, to learn, to discuss issues and academics, to encourage others. He was involved in the fight for civil rights. We're going to learn about all of that and more as we explore an important part of Rochester history with author Rodney Brown. His new book is the story of Freddie Thomas, called Silent Leader. But before we get to that, I want to shift the conversation to something that is happening in the news really hour by hour today. Michelle Faust is here, who covers the Affordable Care Act. You may know it as Obamacare, and a lot going on today. Michelle,
as we speak.
What is happening as we speak, Michelle?
As we speak, there's another challenge to the Affordable Care Act that's being heard by the Supreme Court in D.C. right now. And really what's at question is four words, established by the state. So what's going on is many people are saying that these subsidies that people get to help pay for their insurance, they're not allowed to get because most states did not create their own exchanges. New York State does have New York State of Health, but many states don't. 34 states do not have their own exchange. So that means that most people are going to healthcare.gov and they're getting their healthcare that way. The question here is, because the Affordable Care Act has the phrase that says established by the state, people can't get subsidies if they went on healthcare.gov. They can, however, if they went to New York State of Health or if they're in one of the other states that did establish their own exchange.
So what do the pundits think is going to happen? We're not going to get a decision on this until the summer. Is that correct?
Yeah, we won't have a decision until the summer. There is some speculation as to what is going to be happening today. I've been reading many blogs as to what's going on as we speak. We will definitely be hearing more during All Things Considered and our other programming over the next few days, mm-hmm. and some analysis of what people are speculating, the justices are thinking. This is not a question of the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. We've already had those. There are several laws. Yep. There are several suits that are questioning the Affordable Care Act. But right now, we're just looking at a statutory interpretation of whether or not the federal government can give people subsidies to help them pay for their insurance. Now, what happens? If people in these 34 states, and there's many different numbers of different estimates of how many people could be losing. It looks like 5.5 million Americans potentially, but there are other numbers being floated out there. It's not quite certain how many people would lose their health insurance if they lost their subsidy. Now, what does that subsidy mean? So you get a subsidy and you are not required to have health insurance if you're not getting enough help. So that's to say, you're not required to have a health insurance if the cost of that insurance is more than 8% of your income. So what is that going to mean for many people? There are many people who are paying. They're getting a good portion of their insurance paid for. About $268 is the average monthly subsidy that people are receiving. What happens if you have to add $268 more to your health insurance coverage each month? A lot of people will have to lose their insurance and different speculation, as I said, of how many people that is. But you know, most people are getting 3/4 of their premiums taken care of. What happens if a lot of people drop out of healthcare.gov, if they drop out of the Affordable Care Act, do not get health insurance? The people who stay on, who are those people going to be? They're going to be the people who are sickest, the people who know that they have pre-existing conditions. This is going to drive up the cost of health insurance
for everyone.
Right,
because they said from the beginning, for this to work, they needed everyone, not just the sickest. They needed young, healthy people, especially in large numbers, to make this work. And so, Michelle, when I see headlines that say this is the lawsuit that could take apart Obamacare, is that why? Is that because that's who would be left? They would lose a lot of the sort of the foundational pegs that prop up the Affordable Care Act?
That's exactly the question at hand. If people have a 35% average annual premium increase in the cost of their health insurance, and those people who are on the federal exchange, that could drive up the cost for everyone. You know, those people drop off the exchange, everyone's costs go up, and then people aren't allowed to, you know, aren't able to make their payments. And really, we've got this individual mandate that means by law, everyone must have insurance. The exception is if it costs more than 8% of your income. If a large enough portion of the population falls in that 8%, there really isn't an individual mandate. And that is the problem. Now, the individual mandate, the problem is going to happen initially. Let's say they go ahead and make the decision to say, this established by the state means it's only going to go for states like New York that establish their own exchanges. What's going to happen, what could happen, is that many people could drop out, and what they call a potential death spiral occurs. That means that many people drop off. Those really, the individual mandate disappears functionally in all of the states that don't have their own exchanges. But what happens eventually? That's going to originally it's going to affect those people. What's going to happen eventually in New York? Right? We have our own exchange. Nothing's going to happen immediately in New York, regardless of the decision made. But if the costs go up nationally, it could mean an increase in cost throughout New York as well and throughout the country. And we're going to hear a cut. We spoke yesterday to Patrick Pilano. He's an attorney at Pilano and Farrow, and he kind of explains what could be the situation in New York.
New York still has an exchange, so there wouldn't be an immediate impact. However, if in other states the mandate becomes questioned because nobody can afford health insurance, then that could be a push to eliminate the mandate. And if that happens, that certainly would have an impact in New York and other states that do even have exchanges.
So all of this comes down to these four words. Justices are asking questions, and you know, many of the people who read these things, the journalists who read these things and who report about these things, are speculating as to what their opinions are based on their questions. And it's pretty much going along the lines of the people who lean more to the left, the people who lean more to the right, going against Obamacare, and the people who are leaning more to the left, going in favor and asking questions that seem more supportive. It's all going to come down to Chief Justice Roberts. In the past, as you know, the last challenge to Obamacare, he was the deciding vote that said, you know what, this is a constitutional program, and that's why it exists today. That's why it was ever, you know, began last
Much
year.
Much to the opprobrium that came from many conservatives in this country who were disappointed in Chief Justice Roberts. That will be fascinating to watch what he decides, or at least helps decide in this case. Okay, so I think we're up to speed. What am I missing here? Anything I'm missing?
No, you know, it's just very interesting the way that the different lawyers are approaching this. Arguing this case for the state is Verrilli, their attorney for the Obamacare, and he's basically saying that we cannot take away for 7.5 million people. We cannot take their insurance away. And he says, realistically, depending on what the Supreme Court decides, they could be doing that. And there's some questions by Justice Alito, for example, who's saying, well, why don't we just put it back to Congress and have Congress take care of it? And as you can imagine, this Congress is tried to turn over Obamacare several times. And he actually asked that question. Justice Scalia had said, well, just send it back and have Congress fix the problem. And he said, this Congress, Your Honor? And there was, you know, a little bit of winking back and forth between him and Nancy Pelosi based on some of the reports that I'm reading, and Pelosi, you know, giggling in the audience there. You know, it really is coming down to party lines, and we really won't know until the summer what happens then to the people who have already received subsidies.
Right now
the Obama administration says they don't have a backup plan. There's some people who are skeptical about whether or not there is an actual backup plan, but there's a big problem that could happen here for many people. But they're saying that they will not take away the subsidies that have already been given, but it could make a big change and a major ripple in what this Affordable Care Act already has been for many people.
Here's a comment from Jake, who's listening, who says, the ACA is here to stay in one form or another. If these subsidies are struck down in some states, Jake says the Republican Party will use this opportunity to craft a similar replacement so that it gains a Republican brand, eliminating the need to have it ultimately repealed, which at this point is politically untenable. I've already heard suggestions they might replace it with something like refundable tax credits. So Jake's point is it's kind of similar to what Michelle is indicating here. We are already talking about 7 to 8 million people who have gotten insurance, and that's why Jake is saying it's politically untenable to tell 8 million people you no longer have insurance.
Jake's not alone in that opinion. A lot of people are saying that regardless of what happens, there will be some sort of Affordable Care Act. They may change the branding. It may change in the way that it functions. And the thing is, it will change. It's going to have to change in many different ways. It's going
sure.
to evolve.
Every program changes, but that doesn't mean repeal or a fundamental change in terms of removing insurance from 8 million people.
Well, really what we're doing today is speculative journalism. We're looking at a lot of things that we already know, and we're trying to guess what these different justices are going to decide. They're indicating, and based on the questions that they're asking, but it looks really, like I said, by party lines, but it's really going to come down to Chief Justice Roberts and what he decides. And it'll make a big change. We don't know what it'll be. It won't be a big change in New York State, not this year. But next year, I think, if depending on what they decide, there could be some major changes in the way this program functions.
Before I let Michelle go, I will say, and I want to stress this, her coverage on the Affordable Care Act has routinely, consistently been looking at the issues, politics be damned, and I want to get to a phone call, but our job today is not to be political. Tom in Rochester has some thoughts on that regard, though. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think that in terms of the conservative right wing who are bringing the suit in this case and challenging Obamacare, it really is, I think, exposing their hypocrisy, because conservative jurisprudence should be about humility. It should be about respecting the wishes of the people. They've elected Obama twice, who was the one who brought the Affordable Care Act. But also, it's a principle of how you interpret a law, a statute, that if you have one option which saves the law as being constitutional and the other as throwing it out, you should look for the one that allows you to save the law as being constitutional because it was passed by the legislative body. So this is a very aggressive, unconservative, radical approach that they're taking because they don't like the results of the last two elections and they can't abide the fact that Obamacare was passed. So we need to understand where this is coming from.
Tom, thanks for the call. On his point about saving the law versus scrapping it, it's interesting. John Roberts' language in the decision Michelle referenced, the first big one, is the ACA constitutional law. John Roberts' language was pretty similar to what Tom was saying, which is essentially, look, we've got to look at what Congress has done and then decide, is there a way to look at this in constitutional framing or not?
Well, I just want to get back to it. It's true that there's movement to overturn the Affordable Care Act. This won't overturn the Affordable Care Act. What it could do is take away its teeth. This is looking at the way that we read those four words established by the state, whether or not the IRS, because this comes down to a tax situation. Are people getting help on their taxes? Are they getting tax credits given to them to help them pay for their premiums? And the IRS right now is saying, regardless of the exchange, if you are applying for a credit and you have already accepted it and you already qualify for it, we'll give it to you whether you're in New York State, whether you're in another state like Virginia that is on healthcare.gov instead of on a state exchange. That's what we're looking at right now. It's not a question of whether or not this is constitutional. There are plenty of constitutional arguments against it as well. There's plenty of lawsuits against the Affordable Care Act. But right now, we're just looking at maybe taking away the teeth. If you take away the subsidies, less people will be enrolled. If less people are enrolled, it takes away, it really puts financial pressure. This is all about financial pressure on individuals, making the cost of insurance go up, and then people not being able to get the subsidies that right now they do qualify for.
To some degree, it's like saying, hey, you've got a car. I'm not going to take your car away, but I've got to take away the back wheels. Well, good luck driving it. Good luck driving it. And that's so in some ways, that's what we're looking at. Again, you're going to get a decision in the summer. Michelle Faust, how many states have their own exchange? 16?
We've got 34 states without exchanges that are at risk of losing these subsidies.
New York is one of the 16 that do have
it. Yeah, New York is one of the states that does have an exchange. So like I said, nothing is going to happen in New York right away. But that financial pressure could make some changes next year on the New York State of Health. And we'll just see what that is. And we won't even have an inkling of what that is until the summer.
If you have questions or comments about the Affordable Care Act, Michelle Faust?
Yes. Send us an email, acawxxi@wxxi.org. And always, please be reading our reporting. We're doing lots of work at wxxi.org/ACA. It's not all just about the healthcare law. We have a lot of questions and answers about that. If you have your own questions, please do send it to that email, acawxxi@wxxi.org, and follow us on Twitter, #ACAWXXI.
We're going to take a 60-second break, and we're coming back talking Rochester history. There are certain names when you think about Rochester history that are central to the history of the city, the development of the city, civil rights movement, and more. And there's one name that I think maybe isn't understood well enough, and that's about to change. Short break. We're exploring the life of Freddie Thomas next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we'll talk about the Justice Department's report on Ferguson, racial profiling, our concerns about Ferguson, and whether there are lessons to be learned across the country. Then, what if all of Rochester read the same book? Writers and Books has picked their selection for 2015. We'll talk to the author of The Age of Miracles. Join us Thursday on Connections.
Donations to the Clinton Foundation help it provide much-needed aid around the world. Some say that donations from foreign governments provide them with much-wanted access to Hillary Clinton.
The foundation, in this case, has been particularly forthcoming about who the donors are, but that doesn't wash away the question of influence and power.
That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. It's one of the shortest breaks you'll find on any radio program, and so our guests have reconfigured and our studio filled now with people who are going to tell us a little bit about Rochester history. And again, let's go back to 1952. Freddie Thomas comes to Rochester, and he became known for many things. This was sort of a fascinating Renaissance man kind of a guy, pioneering research in genetics and plastic surgery, educational learning center right out of his home, right out of his car, I guess. We're going to hear about all kinds of great stories there, civil rights and more. And I don't know why we don't hear his name more often, but let me ask the man who wrote his biography. The book is out now. It's called Silent Leader. Rodney Brown is here. Rodney, we don't hear Freddie's name as often as we should, do we?
No, we sure don't. And this was one of my major motivation to wanting to write this book. When I heard his story, it was such a magnificent story. When Ms. Thomas, this basically gave me an outline of it without me even really getting profound in depth with the story. And what I heard was so magnificent that this transcends all the things that we should find important, which is the fight for civil rights, which is the fight for, good education among all our students in the city of Rochester and beyond Rochester, because Freddie was also internationally known on the educational and on the scientific level. So just learning about so many things that he did and then seeing that when I Google his name that I find very, very little was very disturbing to me. So I thought that it was a great project for me to take up, and here we are today with the biography of Dr. Freddie Thomas.
Well, my colleague Helen Biondutti Hofer had Rodney and Midge Thomas, who's also in studio with us, and Midge is the wife of the late Freddie Thomas. I've got the book here. It's called Silent Leader, and Helen Biondutti Hofer contacted me, and she said this was one of those stories that she knew when she was sitting down with both of you. 8-9 minutes flies by on television, and she said, it's not enough time. You've got to try to understand the man. And so, Midge, I know half an hour for your husband's life is not enough, but we're going to try to do it as best we can.
Okay.
How are you, by the way?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Well, and what do you think of the book, Silent Leader?
I think the book is fascinating. It's the first time that people can read and learn more about Freddie. People have asked, who was Freddie Thomas? And Rodney was inspired to write this book. And I think he did a fantastic job doing a lot of research about Dr. Thomas. And I'm very pleased that he was the one that I gave permission to study Dr. Thomas.
Well, and your husband's name, if people know it in Rochester, they usually know it for what? For the school, right?
Yes, that's right.
They know it as Freddie Thomas School.
Right, yes. It's called Dr. Freddie Thomas Learning Center.
And so now, again, if you've heard of that school, now you're getting a sense for who he was. So 1952. Rodney, I want to start with you on this, and then we're going to get to Midge because you didn't meet Dr. Thomas until...
56.
1956, all right. Yeah. So 1952, he shows up in Rochester. From where, by the way? He was he had traveled a bit. Where was he coming from?
Well, he was at Albany Medical College in Albany, New York. Mm-hmm. He recently had graduated from Wagner College in Staten Island with a B.S., degree, and he wanted to go on to get his medical degree, so he went to Albany Medical School. And there at Albany, while he was studying, to get away, he also used to come down to Rochester to get away. He had a brother named John, fraternity brother named John Lewis. Him and John Lewis, who was a fraternity brother from Philadelphia, they integrated Wagner College. They were first two persons of color to enter Wagner College Medical School. So they remained a very close relationship when they both left Wagner College. So he used to come down and visit him. And when he came down and visit John Lewis in 1952, and he described Rochester as finding heaven. Rochester was as a place of finding heaven. He said it was so quiet and it had a lot of, should I say, black togetherness. The communities, the black communities in Rochester were together. They had, should I say, a love for each other. It was something like the Harlem Renaissance back in, should I say, the early 1900s. Century, all the way from, should I say, the 1901 up to 1929 before the Great Depression. It was something like the Harlem Renaissance, where you have the influence of jazz, when you have bustling black businesses, when you have the black community really moving towards social mobility. And a lot of that was because of segregation. The black Rochesterans started moving toward that, investing in their own community because of segregation. So therefore, they felt they could do something for the community. Why not invest in their own community? So therefore, you had all these businesses, black businesses and things, flourishing in the Third Ward and the Seventh Ward. And when I talk about the Third Ward, I talk about Jefferson Avenue. I talk about Cornhill District. When I talk about the Seventh Ward, I talk about Joseph Ave at his heart. Those were where all the blacks migrating from the South really concentrated. And you had a lot of businesses and things. And should I say, again, black people togetherness at this time. So when Freddie came along, it reminded him of his childhood, going to New York City during the Harlem Renaissance and this being around all that black togetherness, when all the black literature and artists and poets and theaters, when the black literary scene and the artist scene was exploding in music and art and poetry and theater, this was a time that he remembered in Rochester when he arrived in 1952.
And you describe him feeling very warmly about that, seeing this community that's forming. But I think some might be slightly uncomfortable to think that the segregation you're talking about was a positive. I mean, in many ways, we've talked about the dangers of segregation, Rodney.
Right, right. It was a unity. Togetherness was a unity compelled by segregation.
Compelled by segregation. You're saying there was an arms linked, let's make our way together.
Let's make this work. Because the social services wasn't there for them. The safety nets that we have today that is offered by Monroe County, those social nets was not there. So the only really social net was to come together and really do for themselves far on an educational and a social level.
Midge, where did you grow up?
I was born right here in Rochester on West Main Street, the Rochester General Hospital.
Okay, and so the Rochester of the 1950s, of the 1952 that Rodney's describing, that certainly that Dr. Thomas found here, what was your view of Rochester at the time?
Well, we lived in Mumford. I was raised in Mumford. So Rochester was a place where we would go socially. Mm-hmm. Churches were very prominent in our social part of our lives. And it was... like Rodney said, that it was a place where we could be together as like brothers or sisters or what have you. So it was not like it is now. You can go out and more people are more or less strangers to each other. But at that time, families knew other families.
It felt more like a small town that was becoming a bigger town?
Right, yeah, right.
Interesting. And so Dr. Thomas comes here, and you met him in 1956?
Yes.
Do you remember meeting him?
Definitely. There was a girlfriend who had a birthday. She was a member of our church, and she had a birthday party. Freddie happened to be her neighbor, and she invited him, and of course she invited me, and we met there, and we had our first dance, and the rest is history. We married we met in May of 56, and we married in February of 57.
Who was a better dancer?
Me.
she always forgets to mention, I love the little part where Freddie mentioned a guy who was sitting on the couch next to him at the party that Midge was going to be his wife. Without her consent, he just told the guy that she was going to be his wife. She didn't even haven't even met her yet or anything.
Did Midge hear him say this?
No.
Okay.
She learned it afterwards.
So, Midge, were you one of those women who back leads, who's, my wife is a better dancer than me, and she cannot tolerate my lack of skill, so she does what we call back leading. Were you a back leader? You have to drag Freddie around?
Just a little, but I wanted him to be the leader, so I sort of backed off a little bit. And after we had our first dance, then the next, the question always is your name. You exchange your name and phone number and all that sort of thing. That night we ended up getting to know each other a little more. And 5 months after, well, we met in May. September 1st, I received a diamond. And then February was our walking down the aisle. And
that was fast.
Well, it was normal to us.
Talking to Midge Thomas, the wife of the late Dr. Freddie Thomas, and Rodney Brown, who's the author of the new book, Silent Leader, the biography of Dr. Freddie L. Thomas. So that's the 1950s, and Rodney, at the time, his career, what was his focus in the 1950s when he arrived in Rochester?
Well, when he arrived in Rochester, as I mentioned, he described it as fine in heaven. And therefore, he loved it so much, he went back to New York City, grabbed his things, and moved down here immediately. So that's how much, should I say, promise that he saw in Rochester. Now, at that point, started studying on his own. He was that type of person. Born in Virginia during the days of Jim Crow, he always had to study alone all the time. So taking correspondence courses, even though that he went to Virginia State College, he had to take correspondence courses. That means that he wasn't in the college, but he took course out of the college. So he also enrolled himself in things like anthropology, paleontology, you know, astronomy, all those types of things. He learned these things on his own. He was that type of person. And so he moved down to the YMCA. He went to Wagoner College, and Wagoner College was a Lutheran proseminary college to teach Lutheran ministers. So therefore, he had a very religious background dealing with the church. So YMCA was a perfect spot for him to be. He already had a relationship with most of those types of institutions. So he parked there at the YMCA, stayed there for a while. Then he went to apply for a job at Kodak. As a scientist, he was immediately hired at Kodak in the emulsion research division, which is the most, critical division of Kodak. All this chemistry and physics that dominate the film process come out the emulsion division. And Freddie was the only person of color in the division at that time, a senior scientist, and the only one with an office, as a person of color. And it was very hard to get in Kodak at that time, because Kodak wasn't hiring people of color at all, but Freddie was able to get in just because his basic knowledge was so overwhelming that they had to hire him.
They couldn't say no. And so this was, Mitch, did you know him by this time?
No, I didn't know him at that time, but I remember him telling me that before he went to Kodak, he applied at Genesee Hospital, and they told him the only available employment was orderly. And here he is coming out of Albany Medical School, studying to be a surgeon, and they offered him to be an orderly at the hospital, which was sort of a little disappointing.
Oh, it's an insult, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, and so our listeners on this program regularly know that I really believe you, if you really love something, if you love someone, then you're honest about what they've done wrong. And you look at Rochester's history. I remember conversations with people like Carvin Eisen and Chris Christopher have put these films together who help us understand right. that time. And you look at that time and you think you had families, particularly a lot of black families, coming to Rochester because there were jobs, that there should have been opportunity, there should have been housing, and you come here, and if Dr. Freddie Thomas is the first person of color in a world in which you really can't get hired if you're black at Kodak, and again, I'm not, this 2015, it's a different world right now.
Right.
I certainly hope so. But that's amazing to me, Midge. And we're going to get into, in just a moment, the civil rights aspect of your husband's work. But that had to be gratifying for him to get the job, but also it had to be terribly sad to look around and see a world of white around you when you know that it shouldn't be that way.
Yes. And still at Kodak, there is evidences of prejudice that he had to encounter. And that was one of the reasons why he left Kodak. And people at Kodak says, no one leaves Kodak. We fire people, but they don't leave on their own. But he did.
Mm. Well, Rodney, from your work on looking through his life, you know, that's a chapter in Rochester's history that we have to learn from. And it is remarkable, his achievements there. But what did that do for his thinking when it came to what he should do for civil rights?
Well, one of the main things that he saw that was beyond the unity compelled by segregation, he saw the unity also as a means to gain some type of political power in order to change the housing situations that's going through the black community, the educational situation that's going through the black community, the employment situation that was going on in the black communities in Rochester. So he saw that unity as a way to try to make that into some type of political force. And during that time, he didn't want insignificant changes. He wanted transformational changes. In order to get those transformational changes, he knew that he needed political relationship in the chambers of Capitol Hill. One of the people that he knew in private life was Senator Ambassador Kenneth B. Keaton. We have a building right here on State Street that's named after him, the Keaton Building. And him and Keaton had a special relationship going on, and he felt that Keaton would be a good advocate to get the voice of the black community in Rochester to be heard in Washington. And he held several, get-togethers in his home for Keaton, where he came and where he was there many times to meet the people and speak with the people and hear their voices.
Yeah, that's true.
and one of the most beautiful things about that relationship between Kenneth Keaton and Dr. Thomas is that it expanded his voice within the Rochester community as far as getting things done. And then I also brought along our Rochester first congresswoman that he also supported, which was Judy Weiss. Judy Weiss. She was also very prominent in the Thompson's home that he helped through the campaign so we can get the black voice heard in Rochester. And they basically dealt things like the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which was a bill to outlaw segregation in all public facilities, education, housing condition, and things of that nature. Throughout the books is illustrations of Dr. Keaton in the home of the Thompsons, personal letters that he wrote about fighting for the civil rights legislation. So we have illustrations, letters, and all the things that was going on during that time with Freddie and Kenneth Keaton, Jody Weiss, and many others like Frank Horton and many other congressmen was fighting for civil rights as far as dealing with segregation.
Well, let me ask Midge then, during those years, what were your conversations with your husband like when it came to what did you think could be accomplished?
I recognized and understood where his philosophy was, and I was sort of like the supporter background of doing the things that wives do at that time. I was impressed with the important. Well, I thought they were important people.
They were important people, weren't they?
Yes, yes. And also, he was able to speak to the, I don't want to say the underprivileged folks on a very social level and educational level. And in the meantime, he would be speaking to those who are in the medical or the religious or the scientific area fluently, comfortably. And the people of, the, as they say, the guys in the streets didn't recognize the other part of Freddie Thomas. And those who were at the University of Rochester and whatever, they didn't understand how he could very fluently hang out with the gangs, which was very interesting. So he
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, he was able to talk to those, what we used to call dropouts. And he was very influential in the youngsters who had were discouraged at their school level, who went to, in fact, we ended up, Freddie ended up grooming them back into school. And we had a connection with the Ralph Bunche Scholarship Fund and sent many of the students to college. And they're successful today. Because, and they will, you will probably be meeting them Saturday. They will be telling you how they were dropouts and quit, and they didn't have education for jobs or whatever, and now their salaries are very successful.
Now, Midge, your husband was becoming tremendously successful in his own right.
Yes.
He was involved in many different efforts from his own work career to civil rights, etc. He didn't have to spend some of that time with, as you say, either gang members or dropouts. Yeah. And some people would have said, you know, some people are sort of naturally scared to reach out to, in that way. What was his, what did he tell you? But why did he do
it? Oh, those children visited our home. We had extra plate at the table. When they knocked on the door, they came and sat at the table.
But phenomenal.
I taught them manners. And they were part of our family, and I enjoyed that because it gave me an opportunity to share some of my background and to see those children grow. It was amazing, and it was a good feeling.
You can't change every single life, but did you see some children as they grew up learning manners in your house, learning about the value of education? You saw change?
Oh, definitely. We had to train them because they were going to college. And I, both of us taught them that when you go to college, it's a different environment than your Rochester family home. And one of the fellows thought that he could find a girlfriend and whatever and marry her. But I told him when she takes him to her family, her dad is going to be looking at her and looking at him. And I know one incident, the father told the daughter, you don't get the support, financial support, if you hold on to him.
Oh, boy.
And they came back to tell us that.
They told you that.
Yes.
They opened up to you. What an amazing home situation. In fact, I want to make sure our audience understands this part of Dr. Freddie Thomas that I think Rodney Brown does a nice job of chronicling in the new book, Silent Leader, that your home was a fascinating place. I mean, you welcomed children. You had, it felt like hearing about more like a community center.
It was exciting. It was very active. From all levels, from diplomats from all over the world, we hosted people from China, Japan, Africa, Europe, through the United Nations. So some of them lived with us 2 or 3 weeks, some lived with us a month, or some lived with us for a week or a few days. So through Freddie's background, that program came through United Nations.
What was it like for you having people in your home that often?
Stimulating and alive, and we had something to talk about during our marriage that was wholesome. And we loved each other, and it sort of brought us closer because we had something that was valuable for us to share. It just so happened that my background and his background seemed to be nearly the same, so culturally it fit.
Well, if I could, I'd love to play a comment, some of the comments from William Lewis, who was interviewed for Need to Know, my colleague Helen B. and Duty Hofer's program. William Lewis is a retired principal from the Rochester City School District.
In fact, Bill Lewis was part of the gang that was a dropout.
Amazing story. Let's listen to some of his comments about those days, Freddie Thomas, and the approach that the Thomases took. Let's listen.
Freddie Thomas was a confidant, very good friend of mine. Matter of fact, Freddie Thomas was a pretty good friend of most people. That's the kind of individual he was. I was working at Kodak, and he's talking to me all the time about going to school. And one of the things I said to him, I think I'm going to go to the University of Buffalo when I had gotten accepted there. University of Buffalo, yeah, what is the university? Oh, here comes Freddie Thomas again. University where you go get an education, is it? Oh boy, so you don't need to go to the university. He said, because the root word for university is universe. And he said, so are you going to be in the whole universe? I said, I hope to function somewhere along the way. He said, well, if you get an education, that's what you have to do. And one of the things he said to us, when you get an education, you can be the most brilliant person in the world. But if you don't share it with others in the universe, you're really dumber than they are. Not only was his house a library, but his car was as well. He drove an old Oldsmobile, and the back seat of his car and the trunk was loaded with books. And we used to be on Jefferson Avenue hanging out once in a blue moon, and we see him over there. And if there was discussion taking place, he would be the one who would come up with the solution. If Freddie Thomas was here to this day, I think he would want to be a quiet person. I think he wanted to share his knowledge with others. And at the same time, he really did not want credit for it.
Talking about Dr. Freddie Thomas, books in the back seat, Midge, is that right?
That's right. In the trunk of the car.
And what a great story that is. And Rodney Brown, when you hear those comments there, I mean, you did so many interviews for preparing to write Silent Leader. This was a guy who really spread his knowledge. This is my favorite part of the Freddie Thomas story, is that he spread the gospel of education just about everywhere he went, didn't he, Rodney?
Yes, that was pretty much his calling card. Is this spreading education, and equally significant. And I want to say that because the focus of the biography is not specifically centered on the scientific aspects of Dr. Thomas' life, but also the political and social environments of the communities he's encountered. Now, equally significant, he reached out to young people, as Ms. Thomas was saying, both from prominent and poor families, including gang members, to teach them the importance of obtaining a quality education. He spent an enormous amount of time with youth, teaching them everything from basic rudiments of English and mathematics to complex mathematics, physics, philosophy, and religion. It was his way to seek out youngsters in the streets, get them interested in learning, and then teaching them if they're willing to apply themselves. He tutored all kinds of people in all kinds of places. Although he never had a teaching certificate, and never received any financial compensation in return. He didn't do it because he was after any gain of money or power. It was his natural way of living. He was indeed a silent leader.
I think that's well said. Go ahead, Midge.
I remember in our travels going to Norfolk, we stopped at a service station, and he started teaching the young children, about 10, 11, 12 years old, about botany. And he took the leaves of the bushes and started teaching them to learn the difference between a weed and a flower. And he reached down and got a little stick and started teaching them mathematics just from the ground. And they learned their arithmetic, what we used to call arithmetic, just from him teaching them there at the service station. And every time we travel south, we stopped at the same service station and saw the children, and they were very happy to see him. They remembered him from before, maybe 6 months ago.
We lost Dr. Freddie Thomas too early, and that's part of life. But you know, Midge, I wonder what you think your husband would think of the state of our country in 2015. Tomorrow on this program, in our first hour, we're going to talk about the Justice Department's report on Ferguson. We're not going to talk specifically about the Michael Brown case, but we're going to talk about a department and a city that was sending internal emails, one in 2008, 7 years ago, 2008, in which one of the emails said, after President Barack Obama was elected, well, he'll be out of office soon. How many black men hold a job for 4 years? Shocking. We're not talking 1952 Rochester. We're not talking about 1964. We're talking about now. And at least the comfort is that when we hear that, we are shocked that that is not customary, that is not accepted, but that's still here. What do you think your husband would think?
You know, it's interesting that it's the same thing. Things have not changed from then until even now today. There are the way people think, their philosophy from their parents or whatever. It's all the same. And if those people who can make changes do what is right, then our city would be much better. But you can't change people like overnight or snapping your finger or whatever. But the people, those in power in our community, Rochester and Monroe County, I think they need to step up a little more. And I see part of the black community working very diligently, making changes, but they don't have the support of those who could be helpful. Our community could be much further ahead if those who could help make a change. And I see these organizations working almost 10, 12 hours a day, mm-hmm. volunteering, mm-hmm. and they just need the support of those people who do have means or have the power to help make the change. That's important. And I think that's part of what Dr. Freddie Thomas was saying, those who can help make change, for them to step up to the plate.
And then that's the biggest thing, despite just studying him for 3 years, just writing this biography. One of the things I think that Dr. Thomas would say or would want to see happen or would be involved in making it happen today is that back in 1964 and in the early 60s and the 50s, he always used to say that the community was too fragmented, and particularly the black community, and they're too dependent. They need to be more self-sufficient. So I think that he definitely would have called for the black leaders in the community and to come together and be more self-sufficient, to be more involved in your community, do more for your community, and stop being such dependent on outside, but more dependent on what you can do yourself inside the community.
I think one of the concerns when you hear about stories like Ferguson and the emails that were exposed, the racism that does still exist, is the concern I have, Rodney, is it could give, especially young people, the false perception that there's nothing you can do to help yourself, that the world is stacked against you. And that's a poisonous mindset. That's how you end up dropping out of school or in a
that's
gang.
Right.
So I'm not saying everyone has the exact same shot. We don't. I mean, that's not, unfortunately, the way the world works. But you can't grow up thinking you've got no shot or that people are out to hurt you, right?
Definitely. And that's the point. And that goes just tie right back into what I was saying about self-sufficiency. Dr. Thomas would be the guy on the street to find youth, the tomorrow of the community. Mm-hmm. And he would tell them, look, you need to get a quality education. And you don't need money to get it. I'm going to give it to you. So what he would do, that he would go around with a trunk full of books in his back seat, his front seat, give out books, tell them come by. He would teach them, study them, not only teach them education, but also teach them social manners and how the way to carry themselves. So so what he would say is that we need to get our adults right now in prominent positions in our community. They need to come back and get with the youth and share their profession, share their career, be involved in helping them get an education. Now, Ms. Thomas, she created what you call an ambassador program in 2005 when Dr. Freddie Thomas Learning Center was in trouble as far as educational achievement of the students, and was on the registration list by the state. What she did was created an ambassador program where she had 46 people, males and females, black and Latinos, and she had these people of all different professions in the community come back and visit the kids the projected kids at Dr. Freddie Thomas School that was having a problem, and meet with the family of those kids two times a week. And after a while, that ambassador program was so effective, which is a part of Dr. Freddie Thomas' philosophy. That was, she implemented Dr. Freddie Thomas' philosophy. And it was so successful, 2 years later, teachers at that school in the city school district was in Washington, D.C., getting the Panasonic Award for the only high school in the country that year to achieve such high heights by graduating 100% of their students and improving in all areas.
All right, well, let me at least let our listeners know. If you want to get the book, it's called Silent Leader by Rodney Brown, the biography of Dr. Freddie L. Thomas. This is our community and our history. Rodney, where can they get the book?
They can get the book at www.drfreddiethomas.com. Also, they can also pick up the book at 323 Aldine Street, Rochester, New York, 14619.
There's book signing.
Yes, and we also...
thank you, Midge. Go ahead. Rodney, she's
right.
Correcting you. Go
she's
ahead.
She's correcting me. She's right. Definitely. She's definitely on point. We have a book signing Saturday, March 7th, from 11 o'clock to 4 o'clock at the Dr. Freddie Thomas Learning Center at 625 Sayo Street. A lot of his students, friends and associates, and very important political dignitaries will be there. So March 7th, Freddie Thomas Learning Center, book signing.
All right. Thank you, Rodney, for sharing your story, really sharing the story of this important person in our community. Congratulations on Silent Leader. That's out now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Midge, I so appreciate meeting you and you sharing your stories as
Thank
well.
You.
And I hope you're proud of the book and certainly we're proud of your family. Thank
I
you.
Am.
All right. Thanks for watching today on City 12 and listening on WXXI, WEOS, WRUR, maybe the WXXI mobile app. Val is our wonderful engineer. I'm Evan Dawson, and you've been listening to Member Supported Public Radio.